Welcome to the Senate Education and Workforce Committee. Welcome all of you, and please, if you have a cell phone, I'll repeat it once again, turn it off, or you will make a contribution to the Common School Fund. And if you haven't signed up, you can do so over there. And we are going to bounce around a little bit because we have members who need to leave right away. So we're going to first open a work session on Senate Bill 765. Marjorie, tell us about that, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we last heard Senate Bill 765 on the 4th of April. At that time, we heard about the Dash 3 amendment that makes extensive changes to the original bill. And the bill has a subsequent referral to revenue at this time. However, I'm sure that's up for negotiation if you choose to send it elsewhere.
Oh. Yes, I think we are. I believe that we are not going to send it to revenue. It's going to go directly to Ways and Means. So let me first, we're in a work session. We heard this bill. I put Senator Cruz on the work group. He did a fabulous job. Senator Cruz, do you want to give us a little update?
Well, I think we last hearing, Madam Chair, we really went over the details of it. There are some people that have concerns, but I think there are people that have concerns anytime we're making changes. This is some significant changes. I think the reason for rescinding the referral to revenue is this doesn't touch the formula in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't actually make any significant changes till next biennium. It just allows us to put them in place. The reason the bill needs to go to Ways and Means is it will have an impact on the department's budget, and not in a way that really alters the direction they're going anyway, but it might accelerate some parts of their process. And so I think it's very important that this bill be down there to be fully vetted when they're discussing their budget and what's going to happen inside the department in this next biennium. We've had many meetings about this. I think this is the right direction to go. I think this is an incredibly positive move we're making. There are some concerns over minor issues. I think I would prefer to address them in budget notes that we can attach to the department's budget, just to say, pay attention to this, pay attention to that. But as far as the structure of the bill, I think it's fine the way it is, and I'm not inclined to change it.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. I would like to, do all the committee members have a copy of this? I'd like to pass out, and I'll have to ask you two to share, I'm sorry, I don't have enough, a possible budget note language. Let me read that into the record. It is the intent of the legislature that local school district and education service district officials be involved in the development of a new organizational structure of education service districts. The Department of Education shall report the emergency board not later than October 2005 on the status of the development of proposed models for the organizational structure of education service districts, including a description of the process used to develop the models and the role of local school district and education service district officials in that process. I didn't read the commas because there are a couple commas missing, but with a few commas, I think we're pretty good in addressing that budget note.
Madam Chair, the only correction I would probably suggest in the budget note was the department report not just to the e-board but also to the appropriate interim committee.
Okay. I think that's a good suggestion. Any comment from this end of the table?
We're talking about a change in the designated name for these education service
areas.
Yeah. Instead of districts.
Well, they have to still have both names because there's a constitutional thing for the taxing districts so we do need to maintain education service districts for that purpose. So they will carry two monikers, but I think that's a doable thing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I move the Dash 3 amendments.
Senator
Bill 765.
Thank you. Senator Starr moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 765. I would like to state for my own discussion on the record that after the last hearing that we had where Senator Cruz presented the work group's work, we sent out an email to other members of the work group asking them to respond to some of the concerns that were raised. Senator Cruz and I met with our committee administrator, reviewed those responses, and shopped them around a little bit and decided that we were going to stick with this bill and just move it forward in the process. Change is always difficult for many people, and I think the budget note will address the one concern that was addressed, and we'll just see what we can do. I think this is really good work, and I just really don't want it in this committee anymore because we're closing at the end of this week. Senator Moore said.
Madam Chair, thank you. I like the bill. What started out to be a consolidation, a major consolidation, which could cause many problems, and a major cut in the budget, which would exacerbate all kinds of things, it turned into an excellent plan to improve the service. And so that was the bottom line. First of all, I believe you looked at service delivery and how that was being conducted and looked at how to improve it. And if it required some consolidation, then that was, you know, that's the way it happened. And there was some work on the governance that may have been somewhat controversial. I think I'm fine with that. And after the many, many years and many reports, something I think very positive has happened. So congratulations on your work.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. The governance part was really critical in my thinking,
yeah.
And that seems to be the major sticking point with some folks, but I think it's really important that we have more input and oversight. And you're right, we did start out saying we're going to slice these ESDs down to a particular number, and to do that without consulting the ESDs, I didn't think was fair. These people have to live with this organization or reorganization, and I think they needed input, but they also needed some guidance instead of leaving it up to an interim study. So I think we've accomplished our goals in that regard. And if we get down to 12 or 15 or 8 or 9, that remains to be seen, but that's not for us to decide. Okay, Senator Starr, did you have any comments?
Not comment.
Okay.
I have a motion.
You already moved the dash 3. Any objection to the dash 3? Hearing none, so ordered. Next motion.
I move that the subsequent referral revenue be rescinded and that Senate Bill 765 as amended be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
With the suggested budget note?
With suggested budget note.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 765 as amended, or first he moves to rescind the subsequent referral to revenue and to move the bill as amended to Ways and Means with the subsequent budget note attached. With a due pass recommendation. I think I repeated that. Any objection? Okay, hearing none, so ordered. We're done with Senate Bill 765.
Thank you very much for your patience, and I look forward to pursuing this issue in another committee.
All right, thank you, Senator Cruz. I will probably be seeing that in my Education Ways and Means Committee. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 765. Okay, we're going to whip through some things very quickly. We're going to open a public hearing on HCR 1. You come forward, Representative Lim, while Marjorie tells us about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Concurrent Resolution 1 designates the first Tuesday of the first full week of May as Teacher Appreciation Day, and this is coming to us from Representative Lim.
I think I'm fine. Okay, you were a senator. Now you're back on the other side. Welcome, Representative Lim.
Thank you very much, Chair Walker and members of the committee. And once a senator is a lifetime senator, so you can call me senator anytime.
All right, I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My name is John Lim, state representative from Gresham. Thank you for hearing HCR 1A engrossed. We as Oregonians should follow the lead of the nation and the world in honoring our teachers. We are fortunate to have great teachers, and their hard work should be recognized and appreciated and honored. The origin of our Teachers' Day are unclear. Around 1944, Arkansas teacher Mary White Woodridge began corresponding with political and education leaders about the need for a national day to honor teachers. Congress declared March 7, 1980 as National Teachers' Day for that year only. National Education Association and its affiliates continue to observe Teachers' Day on the first Tuesday in March until 1985, when National Education Association and the National Parent Teacher Association established Teachers' Appreciation Week as the full week of May, as the first full week of May. And October 5, 2004 has been declared World Teachers' Day. On this day, over 100 countries will observe the contribution of teachers. Events are being planned worldwide through the effort of Education International, United Nations Education, Science and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, and other partners. And HCR 1 is our own appreciation day from Oregon for their contribution to this great state. We are struggling funding for education of our children, but without honoring the teacher, but the money is not that much. So it is about time we recognize our teachers and respect them. I come from the country from Korea, where we recognize a teacher at the same level as our parents. And it is time to bring respect to the teachers if you want to teach our children in the right way. So please support HCR 1. The House already passed unanimously. I think this is the right thing to do for the Senate also follow the same thing. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Lim. I'm glad to see that your country honors teachers like parents, because we ask them to be parents when they teach our children in our schools.
Thank you, ma'am.
Any questions from the committee? All right, Representative Lim, we appreciate you coming forward. I'm going to close the public hearing, and then I'm going to open a work session on HCR 1. Senator Starr, would you have a motion for me?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Concurrent Resolution 1 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves House Concurrent Resolution 1 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Close the work session, and who would like to carry that? You're both teachers. Which one of you would like to do that? Senator Starr? Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Representative Lim. Okay. This one?
This one.
Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1039.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1039 allows a person who holds a degree from a post-secondary institution that isn't accredited or approved by the Office of Degree Authorization to claim or represent that they have that degree if a disclaimer is also included. This bill currently declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay, great. Thank you. We have four people signed up to testify: Alan Contreras, Pete Shepard, George Okulich, and Andrea Henderson. And I know this isn't going to take too awfully long.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'll be very brief. This bill arises from litigation in which the constitutionality of ORS 348609 was challenged by a school that was not accredited as defined in that law. Current law forbids nearly every use of degrees issued by schools who are in that characterization, and that near total prohibition sparked a First Amendment challenge to the constitutionality of that statute by the school in question, Kennedy Western University. That litigation developed in the federal district court here in Oregon, and it became clear to us that the most cost-effective way to solve this problem for the state of Oregon was to propose that the statute be changed rather than go through the expense of litigating the case. And so this bill proposes to change the statute and thus would avoid any further litigation as to that piece of the settlement agreement, would avoid set the foundation for the avoidance of further litigation and expense associated with that to everybody involved, the school as well as the agency, the Office of Degree Authorization. Let me just say briefly that the model adopted in the bill is very consistent with one of our basic consumer protection predicates, and that is that in a free market economy, buyers and sellers of goods and services are most likely to arrive at the best and most mutually agreeable transaction if each is fully informed about the quality and characteristics of what the seller has to sell and what the buyer has to buy. And so this bill proposes just exactly that model in requiring individuals who have these degrees from unaccredited schools, permitting them to use those, but requiring them to disclose the nature of the school from which they obtained it so that the buyer of those goods or services can make the appropriate inquiries and they can strike the appropriate bargain. So that's the model, and we commend this bill to you. I think Mr. Contreras is next.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alan Contreras, Administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization. I have very little to add to what Pete has said. Our office supports this bill. It strikes an appropriate balance between dealing with the legal issues, solving the constitutional problem, and still providing an adequate level of consumer protection with regard to degrees of this sort. I really have nothing else to add, but if you would have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. I will mention that there may be House amendments to this bill because the bill may be the best vehicle to deal with another issue that's being worked out on that side. But I don't have anything else at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Contreras. Mr. Okulich.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Okulich, here today representing Kennedy Western University. I don't have much to add either, except representing Kennedy Western, we are a party to the litigation, and we are here in support of the bill. The one thing I would add is that the settlement does not require any Oregon employer to accept unaccredited degrees as valid credentials or change the requirements for state employment, professional licensures, college admission, or any other area where a degree from an unaccredited school is required. So I would urge your support.
Well, I think it's convenient. We just happen to be in legislative session, so we can fix that little statutory problem for the settlement, don't you all? All right. Could one of you step back so I can hear from Andrea?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. We have a very minor issue with the bill that we'd like to fix on the House side,
okay.
But just wanted to get it on the record so you'd be aware of it, and we have talked with the proponents of the bill regarding this issue. We just wanted to clarify that particularly our community colleges would not be forced to officially recognize an unaccredited degree and list it in their course catalog and as part of the credentials of someone who is on staff at one of the community colleges. So essentially we'll be seeking a change on the House side to clarify not only will does it not change any of the requirements for employment, but also an employer does not have to list it officially an unaccredited degree if the employer has a policy against that.
Okay.
So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions? Looks like we're sort of being put in a position of supporting this bill. Senator Starr, I'm going to close the public hearing and thank you all for coming. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1039.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move Senate Bill 1039 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 1039 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I will note that it goes against my policy to send a bill out of this committee that still needs work. But this is the last week of our committee, so I will do that since Ms. Henderson stated on the record what the change needs to be made, and so that will serve my purposes. No other discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the bill is approved and sent to the floor. Close the work session, and who would like to carry that? Senator Morissette, thank you very much. Okay. Right along. Okay, we have one quick little bill. So we're going to hear this quick one. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2443.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2443 allows an employee of a school district or public charter school to serve on that district's school board if the school district is small and the person is employed as a school bus driver. This bill declares an emergency and is effective July 1st, 2005. However, we have received the -1 amendment from John Marshall, and that clarifies that the school bus driver is a substitute school bus driver, so it's not their full-time job. So there you go.
Okay, Mr. Marshall, come on up. Well, is this a well-tailored and well-drafted piece of legislation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. House Bill 2443 was brought originally on the House side by Representative Butler to deal with an issue facing a very small and isolated school district in the far reaches of eastern Oregon. As you know, Oregon has many small school districts in isolated communities, and for one small school district, an issue has come up that's troubling to them and very important, and House Bill 2443 seeks to fix that. We're talking about A-Rock School District, and if you have never been to A-Rock, it's about halfway between Rome and Banner. And if you go to Burns and then head 114 miles southeast of Burns, you'll get to A-Rock. It's 30 miles southwest of Jordan Valley, 19 miles northeast of Burns Junction. There are a lot of prairie dogs and sagebrush out A-Rock Way.
Substitute bus driver.
The member of the board of the A-Rock School District is married to the school district's only bus driver. When the spouse bus driver, the woman, is ill, her husband will oftentimes drive the school bus as a substitute. Because of current law that prohibits an employee of a school district from serving on the board, this has troubled the A-Rock School District. It has troubled them because of liability issues, and I might add that the substitute bus driver is fully licensed under Oregon law to drive a school bus. What House Bill 2443 proposes to do is to continue to allow the spouse of the A-Rock school board member to the school board member to continue to drive a school bus on a substitute basis. The proposed -1 amendment merely clarifies that it is a substitute bus driver. This amendment was brought to us, or we brought after a call from another small school district that was concerned about an employee, that is the full-time bus driver, being on the board, and so the -1 amendment merely clarifies that it is, in fact, the substitute bus driver that's able to serve on the board. Representative Butler is okay with that amendment. We'd encourage your adoption and advancement of House Bill 2443 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Any questions? Senator Morissette?
Okay. I guess I was looking for other loopholes that would allow others to serve, but the substitute bus driver is pretty specific.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, it is, and it only applies to the very smallest of school districts, when oftentimes it's difficult enough to find some folks to serve on a board in a small, isolated community, and oftentimes a lot of folks in the community are obviously related. So this is an exception for a very isolated circumstance.
May I? I guess I'm looking at the limitation of the size. Or it's probably right in front of me. The very smallest of school districts.
Line 17 and 18.
lines 17 and 18. Average daily attendance as defined in OR. Okay, a 50 or less. Okay,
so that's 50 or less.
50 or less. Okay, that's what I was looking for. Thank you.
A very small school district.
Indeed.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2443 and open a work session on House Bill 2443. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2443.
Senator Starr moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2443. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2443 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves House Bill 2443 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Close the work session, and I'll carry that fun little bill.
A-Rock School.
I'm going to do a little...
Got a ring to it.
It does, and I'm going to do a little research to see what I can find on the Internet about A-Rock, so we can have a little history lesson on the floor. Okay, so that brings us... there you go. Okay, does that bring us down to our last bill? Okay, that brings us to opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 860. Let me tell you where I'm headed with Senate Bill 860. That bill does not have support on this committee to move in its present form. I've been working with parties to try to come to some agreement on 860 and 560, and so far we've not accomplished that. This committee closes on Wednesday. We have until early tomorrow morning to come up with some answer that satisfies members of this committee and the proponents of the bill. If we don't, the bill will die. Basically, what we're doing today, I put it on for a public hearing because we have some young people here from Springfield High School who commenced a project through DECA about soda consumption at Springfield High School. And I wanted them to present that project because they did it as part of a research project, and they're on their way to their national meeting to present it. And I thought this would be pretty cool for them and informative for us to learn about their project. Those of us on the work group were filled in by their teacher, but I'd like the rest of us to hear that. And then all the other folks who've signed up, if you've testified before, your testimony will be very, very limited today because I've heard it before and I don't want to hear the same thing. We were here 2 full hours on this issue before, so you can testify today, but please remember that if you have testified before, I will make your testimony brief. So let's hear from the students. We have Ken Johnston, Leanne Layton, and Jenny Sumner. And Ken Johnston is the teacher. And the first thing after you introduce yourselves is please tell me what DECA stands for. Because I know it's a very big organization and has great leadership skills for kids, and I just think you need to share that with us. So,
Madam Chairwoman, for the record, I am Jenny Sumner.
And Leanne Layton.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm Ken Johnson, and I'm not here to speak. I'm just a prop today.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnston. Okay. Which of you would like to go first? Make sure the microphone is next to you.
It stands for Distributive Education Clubs of America, DECA does, and it's a great business program that helps us later on in career development and just being able to kind of practice role plays and interviews, and just a great business program.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah. You just learn many life skills that you can use in your future, and it's just a great opportunity to meet people and to travel to different places that you would not have the opportunity to go to otherwise. So,
and you have to choose a project once a year to work on, and this would have been your project?
There's different areas that you can do projects in. There's creative marketing, which is what we chose to do our project in, and then there's various other areas. And you don't have to do just projects. You can do role plays and then tests. So there's different various avenues to go through if you want to compete in DECA. So
okay, and you kids are headed where?
Anaheim, California.
All right. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Okay, well, tell us about your project, the title of it, and your Vanna White is over here ready to display.
Similar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we have problems. The controversy over soda has become huge. And
you're telling me. You're telling me. And it's not limited to just soda. Let me tell you.
And many bills have been proposed that would outlaw soda in schools.
Okay.
Part of the problem is the Register Guard, which is our local newspaper, has been writing very unflattering articles about our school store, which is called the Miller Mart. And they have also even done a political cartoon, which is kind of making fun of what Oregon kids eat. So,
and up in the corner, you can see that even Hillary's after us. So.
And the Register Guard reporter, if he's not in the room, he's not, but he's listening downstairs in his little hole. And I told him that he needs to come up and listen to you students today because you were going to have a presentation. So, David Thieves, if you're downstairs, you come up and meet these young people. All right. Okay, take it away, girls.
Well, so this really is a big issue, and which is why last year our DECA chapter decided to conduct a survey which would help answer a few questions. So, like, the three main questions we really wanted to answer on the survey was how much soda do students actually drink? So we wanted to know if it was within the limits recommended by pediatricians, which is no more than 12 ounces a day, and also where they tend to get the majority of their soda. Is it from the school, or is it from their home, or fast food restaurants and places like that? And then lastly, we wanted to find out how students would respond if we were to remove soda from school. Are they going to continue to drink it, or will they stop if we were to remove it?
And for our survey, we drew a representative sample of 300 students out of our total population, which is 1,600 students. And we got a correct proportion of 9th, 10th, and 11th, 12th graders. So we chose 75 students at random from each class to participate in our survey. It was a statistically valid study, and this helped us to attain a margin of error of 3% and a rate of confidence of 97%.
So these are our findings over here. And the first question we asked on our survey was, how much soda do students estimate they drink on a daily basis? And we actually found that approximately 37% of the students said that they drink 12 ounces or less, and then another 9% don't drink any soda at all, which is approximately 46% of the students who would drink 12 ounces or less a day.
And then our second question was, how much soda did you consume yesterday? So once again, we just wanted to reinstate what we learned from our first question and just take a snapshot of the students during one time of their day. And once again, we found that approximately over half of the students had drank 12 ounces or less of soda, and only like 12, so pretty much the majority again once had the recommended amount of 12 ounces or less.
And the third question we asked was whether or not students normally buy lunch off campus, and this was pretty much to determine if they are buying off campus, we wanted to figure out whether they were getting soda with their lunches. So of that 50%, 75% of the students said that they normally buy a soda with their lunch, which means a large percentage of the students who are having a lot of soda on a daily basis are getting it when they go off to lunch.
And then we wanted to see what size they bought when they do buy a soda with their drink. And we found that 41% are buying the large or the extra large size of soda, which means that only 15% of them are buying the smaller size. So when they do go off for lunch, they are getting the more larger sizes. And you have to consider, though, that there's ice in the cup, so it's a little less soda than what the cup might have, but also they could be getting refills, so it might be more, too.
Okay. Then the next question we asked was we wanted to know where students get their soda, so we had them rate from 1 to 3, 1 being their first choice and 3 being their third most choice of where they get the majority of their soda. And surprisingly, we found that almost 40% of the students said that home would be the first choice of where they would get their soda. And then next would be the Miller Mart and fast food restaurants.
And this kind of goes along with the first question. So of those students who marked 2 for where they get the majority of their soda, home once again came in at top with 25%. And then the Miller Martin vending machines were with 23%. So home once again is where students would get the majority of their soda.
And this was their third choice. So we found that for the third choice, students were choosing vending machines, which are on campus.
For question number 7, we wanted to see if soda was going to be unavailable on campus, what would the students do? And 40% of them said that they would go with soda until after school, and then 37% said that they would bring their own soda. And only 5% said that they would stop drinking soda altogether. So one way or another, they're going to obtain their soda. And some of them even said that they would skip class to obtain their soda.
It's that important to them, huh?
The next question we asked was if it were unavailable at school, if they would drink less soda. And we found that approximately 63% of the students said that they would not drink less soda. So they're still going to drink the same amount, even if it's not available on campus.
And our last question was, how many sodas have you purchased at the Miller Mart in the last week? And approximately 30% of the students had bought no sodas at all in that past week at the school store. And then about 17% had bought just one soda in that last week. And 14% had bought 2. So there's over 50% that had bought 2 sodas or less during the last week at our school store.
So that's the ending of our findings. Based on these findings, we concluded several things. The first was that...
Just a moment. Senator Morrison?
Yeah, thank you. Did you think of asking what kind of soda they consume as a... is it a cola or is it diet or regular? Is it a cola? Is it a Sprite, diet, regular, and so on? You didn't break that down.
We didn't.
No, that's fine. So. I think you did a good job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, you can continue.
Okay, so based on these findings, the first thing that we concluded was that teen consumption is less than perceived. So we actually found that the problem isn't quite as large as we thought it, or as we originally expected, because our sales figures don't match with the ones in the register guard. But our numbers that we found on our survey do match with our sales records. So.
And secondly, we found that if students are consuming too much soda, it's not coming from the Miller Mart. About 50% of the students go off campus for lunch, and 75% of those students are buying soda at the local fast food venues around in our area. And the majority, we found, comes from home. So either if they just bring it from home to school, or if they obtain it after they leave school, the majority of it is coming from their home.
Then thirdly, we concluded that removing soda from schools would have little effect on the consumption, because in the survey, it showed that students will drink just as much soda if it's unavailable on campus, because they're going to go somewhere else to buy it, and so they're just going to drink as much if it's not available on campus.
And our final conclusion that we came to was that if soda was to be removed from schools, our school would suffer great financial losses, and I'm sure other schools would too. SHS, through the Miller Mart and DECA, has been able to buy a new sound system for auditorium, football uniforms for the football team, and just recently we had a girl pass away at our school, and the Miller Mart has donated almost $1,000 to her family to help pay for all of her medical expenses and whatever else they need the money for. So it gives a lot of money per year to various activities and organizations around our school.
So that's the ending of our conclusions, but are there any questions for us about the study?
I think so. Senator Morsett's really intrigued by your study.
I taught at Springfield High School for almost 30 years. I'm totally familiar with the Miller Mart and with Ken Johnson and so on. I haven't met some of the current students. I think it's a great study. I think that DECA, obviously is a wonderful training program and gets you involved in doing a lot of things, including coming up here. I guess what I would be interested in coming back in another year and building upon your survey, and I think you could do it a number of ways by, kind of pinpointing the different types of soda, for one thing. How about going to Hamlin and Springfield Middle and doing kind of a survey there where you have a different setting? Kids don't have a store to go to on campus. Kids don't leave campus. It's a different setting, and that could broaden your survey. I think your survey is very valuable, and I think it's something that could be it's a topic that's not going to go away, so I think it would be good to build upon what you've done. And now, have you done some outside consulting, for instance, with pediatricians or doctors or whatever? Have you done that in relationship to building your survey?
Yeah, the only information we really found out was just that they recommend a maximum of 12 ounces a day. Yeah. So after that, it starts to become really unhealthy. Yeah. But that was about it as far as pediatricians go.
Okay. Well, anyway, I congratulate you. I think you did a great job, and good luck in your and Anaheim taking a ball game while you're there.
Actually, I think it's the 50th anniversary of Disneyland, so you might want to try Disneyland. But ladies, let me ask you this question. When the doctors recommended no more than 12 ounces a day of soda, did they recommend whether that be diet soda or not diet? Did that make an impact, or did they distinguish that when you asked that question?
They didn't distinguish that.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they found that diet it's not a huge difference. Like, it is some, but it's not.
And the calories it is, but it still has the same effects, like, on your bones as regular soda does, so.
Okay. Okay. Senator Starr, did you have some questions?
No, I'm intrigued by this work, and certainly I support these kinds of organizations in our public schools, and I'm sorry we're not funding better to take care of their future.
Yeah, thank you. Do you do all your private fundraising to get any support from the state or the school, or is it all privately funded for DECA?
It's all privately funded.
Okay.
So I think that the Student Leadership Center is funded by the state.
Okay.
That portion is
awesome. Great. Did you ladies, this weekend I rented the movie Super Size Me, since I'm knee-deep into this issue, I thought I should see that. Have either of you watched that film?
Yeah, we actually watched it in our economics class this year, so it was quite interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was. I thought it was quite brave of that guy to eat that kind of food for a month. I know I would have gotten sick the third day instead of when he did, but actually probably the first day. Well, what was interesting out of that movie and his experiment is that McDonald's and some of the other fast food outlets, I believe, others followed suit, got rid of their supersize drinks and their supersize french fries. Mm-hmm. Is that what you understood from that too?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think this is that it's important to raise the public's consciousness about these things. Obviously, you've poked a hole in the theory that it's all coming from soda, and the soda's coming from school, which it appears not to be. And so I appreciate that you took this project on. You might want to take on vending machines next time and those sampling of those products. But this committee wishes you great success at the national competition, and we really appreciate that you've made the effort to come forward and tell us about this study.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, good luck. One more thing?
Yes. What year are each of you? Junior, senior?
Seniors.
You're both seniors.
Yeah.
And what year are you, Mr. Johnson? How long have you been with Springfield High
Thank
School?
You.
I mean, how long have you been teaching this?
Oh, 28 years.
28 years you have been, involved with DECA the entire time?
Even before that.
Even before
started
that?
In 1975.
Wow.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, I had a half year on you when I retired, 28 and a half, so you're going to surpass me. Thank you very much for being here.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Good luck. Okay. Next we have some folks to testify about foods in middle schools. So Zachary McFarlane, Molly Haynes, and Cassie Holder. And I don't think I recognize those names, so I don't think they've testified before.
We have not. We're all new.
Good. We like new stuff.
My name is Carrie McFarlane, and I'm here on behalf of Community Health Partnerships. My understanding is that last week, during your work group meeting, you, Senator Walker, requested some information about foods in middle schools.
I did.
And at 5 o'clock on Thursday, we got that request, and we're very busy on Friday trying to gather some information for you.
Okay.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I found in Portland, and then I'm going to let my colleagues talk about the situation outside of Portland. And I think you'll agree with us that the situation varies depending upon the local control issue, and we're going to demonstrate that.
Okay.
What we believe is that local control works where there's a good policy. The problem is that where there are not policies in place, the foods that are sold are not probably up to the nutritional standards that we would hope for, particularly for this age group of 6 to 8 graders. So in Portland on Friday, 7 schools were visited, covering a total of about 3,500 students. Again, all of those being 6 to 8 grade students. What we found basically is that Portland's doing a really good job. They've got a district policy in place. There is no soda. There is no candy to speak of other than M&Ms mixed in with trail mints. And in our survey instrument, we counted that as candy. But we didn't find any Snickers bars. We didn't find any Tootsie Rolls. We didn't find any gum. We found very few snack machines. Out of 7 schools, there were only 4 snack machines, and there were 16 beverage machines for those 7 schools. In the beverage machines, we found that the majority of the slots were devoted to water, and the second greatest number of slots were devoted to 100% fruit juice, and then a few of the slots, 10 out of 144, were devoted to a fruit cocktail that probably had less than 50% juice. So Portland, we were surprised when we went out. We didn't expect to see such great selections in these machines. Not to say that all of the snack machines were wonderful. Grandma's cookies and Pop-Tarts, for example, were well represented in the snack machines. But the fact that there was no candy and there was no soda is a reflection of local district policy, we believe. And I'll let my colleagues speak to some schools outside of the Portland area.
Great. Good afternoon. My name is Molly Haynes. I grew up in Springfield, Oregon, and actually had Senator Morris out as a teacher there.
Oh, how sweet.
Thought I recognize you, Molly.
I'm a registered dietitian, and I am a student at Portland State in the Master's in Public Health program. I surveyed Thurston Middle School in Springfield, Oregon, and they didn't have quite the policies that the Portland schools do. They have a school store that sells the following: bagels and cream cheese, chips, cookies, several different kinds of candy, granola bars, fruit snacks, Rice Krispie treats, Hot Pockets, ice cream sandwiches, fudge bars, popsicles, sherbet push-ups, frozen go-gurt, Snapple, and Capri Sun. They also have a snack machine that sells mints, gum, Snickers, M&Ms, and a few other types of candy, chips, pretzels, grandma's cookies, some assorted mini cookies, Cheez-Its, yogurt-covered pretzels, trail mix, nuts, granola bars, and Chex Mix. Some of the items were actually labeled as, healthier items, and the snack machine is only available after school, so it's not open during school hours, but it's on for purchase after school. And they also had a beverage vending machine that was also only available to purchase from after school, and it had a big Pepsi logo on the front of it and sold Pepsi products, and also had water and Gatorade and a Tropicana drink, juice drink. And the other school that I was able to get some information on was Conestoga Middle School in Beaverton. They don't have a school store. They have 2 soda machines that carry Pepsi products and 2 juice machines with Tropicana drinks and water in them. So I believe, I don't know exactly what Beaverton's policy is, but they have some sort of policy again, to kind of demonstrate what Carrie was saying about, you know, not having candy. They're available, and the soda machines are only available for after-school purchase. So I'll go ahead and turn it over to Cassie, who's going to... Yes?
Senator Morissette?
Molly, what did you mention about the school store at Thurston Middle?
At Thurston Middle, the school store is open during the lunch hour, and they sell chips, candy. They don't sell soda, but they do sell Capri Sun and Tropicana and different types of ice cream bars.
Okay. But may I follow up?
Yes.
They don't have the pot machines and the machines open during. Now, did you mention Pepsi, Coke?
They have Pepsi products.
Okay.
At Thurston Middle.
Yeah. Okay. Now, are they? But they're not open during school hours. Is that what you said?
The vending machines are only open after school, but the school store is open during the lunch period.
Is it open during, do they have breaks in the morning and the afternoon?
That I don't know about.
Because I think the Miller Mart has a break, at least they used to, in the morning, afternoon, and lunch hour, and maybe and before school. I mean, they're open a lot. But, okay, good. Thank you, Molly.
Hi, my name is Kathy Holder. I'm also a master's in public health student at Portland State University. I was born and raised in McMinnville and went to public school there. I visited Patton Middle School in McMinnville at lunchtime last week and surveyed their cafeteria. They have one snack vending machine in the cafeteria and three beverage vending machines that consist of water, juice, and Gatorade. They have a school store called the Mustang Express that opens at lunchtime. It's very popular amongst the students. They sell donuts, maple bars, Snapple, cookies, chips, and frozen burritos. And that's all I've got.
Would you repeat that list, please? Donuts, maple bars,
Snapple, cookies, chips, and frozen burritos.
Senator Morissette?
Okay, so in both of the middle schools that you visited that have school stores, that can be an alternative to lunch, I imagine?
Yes.
It is. Okay, so that is. And that is the middle school. Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Stern? Nope. All right. Ladies, I appreciate you making that trip and logging that information and sharing it with us. I really do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Craig Mossack, Nancy Becker, and Mary Lou Henrich. Mm-hmm. And you've all testified before.
Oops. Quick.
Welcome.
Great. Hi, I'm Craig Mossback. Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the committee for allowing us to speak again. I wanted to commend those students from Springfield High School on their research. It was very well done. They looked at multiple data sources, did a lot of background research. And I just want to say that, you know, nothing thrills me more than when data informs decision making, which I think we can do here today. The students accurately point out in their study that I read that a comprehensive solution is what is needed to reduce childhood obesity, and that includes both what kids eat and how active they are. But of course, you know, we disagree with one of their conclusions, that drinking soda at school is not a big problem. Their data show that about 50% of kids drink more than 12 ounces of soda a day, more than the recommended amount. And what struck me is that over about 20% of students drink more than 3 sodas a day, and that's about the percentage that's, you know, obese or overweight right now. But the most important point is that the self-reported from the students, almost 40% of the students would drink less soda if it was not available in the school, if it was not sold by the school. You know, the soft drink companies, their job is to sell soda, and that's why they want to be in our schools. They know that kids will drink more soda if it's sold by the school. And the soda companies are also banking on creating some lifelong customers. Soda companies sell soda. That's their job. Our job as parents or legislators is to make sure that we create a healthy environment for our kids. I'm still hopeful that we can reach some sort of compromise to get one of these bills out of committee by the end of this week, and we'd be happy to help with that. Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Becker.
and I'm a registered dietitian. I understand that you asked last week where all the registered dietitians are on this issue, and I'm the policy chair of the Oregon Dietetic Association. I represent over 400 registered dietitians in the state of Oregon. Last week we had our spring meeting, and the topic of competitive foods was on the agenda. Most registered dietitians in our state support some kind of regulation of the foods that can be sold outside the school lunch program. And they do this for several reasons. First of all, they're aware that obesity is the number one health issue facing youth of today. And they're also aware that school food service administrators struggle to provide healthy, appealing foods to kids, but that they have to compete with unregulated junk foods that are being marketed to kids. I spoke to several registered dietitians who are also parents who've tried to change some of the practices in their kids' middle schools as individuals, and they've tried to make changes at the local level, and they have. It was very disturbing, the stories that they told. Principals and food service administrations didn't see eye to eye. There were turf squabbles. Food service workers and administrators couldn't decide which foods to be allowed to be sold, and the schools ended up staying with the status quo, where any and all junk food could be sold. So for us, the issue is not exactly how much pop kids are drinking in the schools. The issue is whether our state has the foresight to enact some standards that would help make kids make the healthier choice. I also appreciate what these high school kids reported, but especially since Senator Walker, you mentioned the movie Supersize Me, we know that kids don't know how much soda they're drinking. And recently a colleague of mine went to a middle school and showed various serving sizes and said, which did you, you know, what would you normally drink? And a kid showed a 2-liter bottle as being one serving size. So I'm not sure the kids can identify what a 12-ounce serving of soda is. That's really a rarity at this point. Most soda is now sold in 20-ounce bottles. So I'm somewhat dubious about that number. So the way we look at it as dietitians is that this is really an opportunity for you guys to provide some leadership and guidance to demonstrate some regulation that would help the local school districts comply with the new federal guidelines. So I really hope you consider enacting some strengthening of some current suggestions for policy that you have before you.
Thank you. Ms. Becker, appreciate your testimony. Ms. Henrich?
Senator Walker, committee. I'm Mary Lou Henrich for the record, and I work for an organization called Community Health Partnership and am a member of the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance. And thank Senator Walker for continuing to struggle with this bill. I know it has not been pleasant at all times, and it's difficult because I think we all come with a variety of solutions to the problem. I don't think many, if hardly any anymore, are arguing that we have an obesity problem with our kids and that we have some things being sold in schools that we all kind of aren't real pleased with. I think that on the committee, the thing that the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance wants to go on record in front of you today, saying that we would support the first three, or actual numbers 1, 3, and 4 from the ODE Task Force on Food Sold in School. There were those policy recommendations with a few clarifications that did stipulate the dates that it had to be enacted by, which would coincide with the federal wellness policy date, which is something like the first day of school following the 30th of June of 2006. A little complicated, but basically schools start at different times, so it's trying to get the first day of school in 2006 as the date to have these policies in place, that they be comprehensive, as was outlined in the ODE task force. And I think actually there is, consensus around from the various factions on thinking those three policy recommendations would be good. But I think where the rub is has to do with if school districts do not put those kind of robust policies into place, if local districts are unable to get together and put that kind of policy into place, then should there be some kind of minimum standard that the state has written into law that would go into effect. And that's where we believe the kind of the concept that we came up with in the last meeting, which was to have consistency between what is being allowed to be sold in cafeterias under the federal USDA guidelines and what's being sold in the hallways, which isn't regulated. And if somehow that basic consistency between making the hallways at least conform with what's sold in the cafeteria, and if we did that during the school day, that would be our recommendation, to take those first three policy guidelines from the ODE Task Force report with the few changes, and then a final one that would say if by that date the district hasn't got a robust policy as we envision, then this would be the fallback.
Let me ask you, Ms. Henrich, when you talk about a robust policy, how do you define that?
Well, I guess I would say that it meets all of the things of number one, of the goals of the nutrition education program of the district, nutrition, food service operations, the sale of foods of minimal nutritional value, food sold as part of fundraising activities, and nutrition standards for all competitive foods. It's all of those pieces that are in recommendation one from the task force, and that if the district then goes through and stipulates what all of those are, to me that's a robust policy.
Mm-hmm. I think place that we left the discussion in the work group was that we would require that each district have a nutritional policy task force, and we were discussing who would be on that task force so that there would be community involvement, because mm-hmm. that's my concern as well. And let me share with you, I went back to school on Friday also. I visited Butte Creek Elementary School and Monitor Elementary School. They're in the Silver Falls School District out in the rural parts of the county. And also a school, Joseph Meek Technical High School, which is an alternative high school in Portland. The students at both of the grades 1 through 8, they had vending machines at one school. They had juice in one and water and soda in the other, but the soda was being changed out per district policy. The other school had changed out the soda to be diet soda and then water. So I spoke to a seventh grade class and talked to them about this bill we were working on and asked them what they thought about it. And they said, we should have some say in what you're doing. And I said, well, do you go out and get a soda during class? And they can. The teacher allows them to go out and get a soda during class if they want, but he says it doesn't happen very often. And, in fact, they did a study at their school, and they found that the kids were consuming an average of 3 sodas a week, but that was because one kid brought 3 sodas a day from home. And so he kind of skewed the report. But they are conscientious about that. They are getting involved. And I really want community buy-in in this because, as you know, from our 4 total hours that we spent in work group, I nearly tore my hair out because we would get into a discussion about what was good and what isn't. For instance, let me go over the list of foods of minimal nutritional value, which we got stuck on. It was here a moment ago. I had my staff go to the website and download the federal regulations. It's water ices, chewing gum, certain candies of the following types: hard candy, jellies and gums, which are gummy bears, marshmallow candies, fondant, which is candy corn, licorice, spun candy, which would be cotton candy, and candy-coated popcorn. So if we went with Senate Bill 860 as written, we'd be banning that stuff as well as soda. But I would submit to you that the worst stuff would be the cookies, the nuts, the chips, the nachos, the chocolate candy bars. Those are the things that I find more offensive in terms of fat, because gummy bears have sugar. And sugar turns into fat, certainly, but I don't think people eat tons of gummy bears or licorice. So that's the problem we continue to get involved in this work group, is how do you come down on what you're going to limit and what you're not? And I felt, and after visiting these schools, I still feel that it's, if you want community buy-in, if you want parents to be involved, and you want parents to understand that these kids are getting these sodas at home, as these young women were able to show us, you got to get the parents involved. And I didn't get elected to sit here and go over a list of foods and say what's good and what's bad. I really, truly think that you need the community to work that out. So we sort of got stuck.
Can I respond?
And you can respond.
Chair Walker and members of the committee, I'd like to respond quickly, and then I'd like to have our dietitian actually speak somewhat about this food thing, about the sugars and the fats and that kind of stuff, because that's her expertise. But I guess we agree with you and have really never disagreed that we don't need local buy-in and that we don't need to have communities involved in setting these policies. And that's why many of us either supported and or served on the ODE task force trying to get some agreement on a process and what ought to happen at the local level. So that's why I do support, and I've talked with people at the Department of Ed that say putting these policies into state law, rather than just having being recommendations out of a task force, really would help in terms of pushing communities forward in really developing what I call those robust policies. So we don't disagree with that. The concern is that in any kinds of groups, when you have 198 groups out there that need to do this, We just would like to have something in case the community doesn't really get it done and get the work done in a timely manner. Not saying that they won't eventually get it done, but that in the meantime, that at least there's a minimum standard. And, you know, we don't love the FMNV definition, you know, it just happens to be what the federal government has in place in the cafeteria during the lunchtime, and it just seemed to be, it was kind of simple to say, okay, the sodas and those candy-type foods just wouldn't be sold outside of the lunchroom. And I think that's what I heard the Department of Ed saying in our little work group, was that is hard when there's inconsistency and kids can go out in the hallway, buy a soda. And we don't disagree that probably in most elementary schools this is not going on. But can I just have Nancy respond to that?
May I just
Yes,
answer?
Senator Morse has a question.
Well, the question is, why don't we have Mel Cohn here? And if we had Mel Cohn here, I think he would talk about the health and safety of the students that we're talking about. And I think it's a state obligation to protect the health and safety.
Yes.
And I see this as a state obligation.
He did testify earlier, Senator Morse said, at the earlier hearing.
Well, he testified for the last three sessions that obesity is a factor that we have to address. Thank you.
So as far as individual foods go, it is very difficult to point your finger at a certain food and say this is a good food, this is a bad food. And that's why the concept of nutritional standards, which is what we had first proposed in Senate Bill 560, was enacted, that these are science-based standards and foods have to, there's no individual food that's labeled either good or bad or worse or better, but that there are nutrition standards that a food must meet in order to be deemed an appropriate snack for children. For instance, a calorie level of, let's say, 200 calories or less, that's an appropriate snack amount of calories for children, because after all, one of the things we're looking at is the obesity issue. But you guys, you know, didn't want to go with nutrition standards. So, but that would be our first choice, because that is really the only science-based way that you can look at something like this. So the next step is thinking about what's the worst offender. And certainly soda, which is essentially liquid candy, is clearly, you know, the leading offender. It's easy for kids to drink a lot of it, and it goes down, you know, really really easy. They don't even understand that they're drinking liquid candy. And children, you know, all kids are going to love to have soda. That's, I mean, I'm not sure what whether children want there to be a limit on soda is relevant, children or teenagers. Of course they don't want there to be a limit on it. I mean, they don't want bedtimes either, but they have, you know, we impose bedtimes on them because as adults we know, you know, we know what's best for our kids. So in some sense, having children say that they want to be able to drink soda is, to me, that's not science. That's of course children are going to ask to be able to have
that's
soda.
What the children asked me, they wanted to be involved in the decision making. They didn't say we want to drink soda. They just want to be involved in the decision making about what changes were going to be made. And I don't think that's unreasonable. Additionally, I think we've had testimony today and previously that the soda's not all coming from school, especially when you have open campus. And they, you know, my old high school that my children went to, Sheldon High School, it's surrounded by fast food places where they get everything they need. They don't even stay on campus. Some of the middle schools have open campus.
There's middle schools. Are there middle schools with open campus?
I believe there are some middle schools where they can go off campus. But whether they can or they can't, they're not all getting their soda from school or at lunchtime. And as the testimony was today from the three women who testified previously, Portland seems to be doing all right.
Portland's doing a great job
in what they're doing. And all, these school districts are having to come on board. They know they have to meet this new guideline that the federal government has suggested. Though, as in the work group, we saw that there were certain flaws in those guidelines, and the flaw being that they don't ask you to address advertising, which I think is absolutely critical when you are discussing your contracts with soda companies and vending machines. You've got to talk about the advertising dollars and how that plays into your nutritional policy. It didn't talk about the federal law does not address fundraising foods that are sold on your campus. It doesn't address foods that are sold. So I remember when I was in school, we took candy bars around in the neighborhood and sold them for a buck a piece. Is that a healthy thing for kids to do? I don't know. The other thing it didn't address was it didn't define who would be on a nutritional policy task force. And I think that was a good addition to the federal law so that we could direct that school districts incorporate, create a task force that has this input from the community. I think that's really important. So that's kind of where I would like to go with this, because I think it's important to direct districts to create these programs, and we need to give them some guidance on that. And again, I think there are 17 school districts that aren't impacted by the federal law. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of sort of where I'm at.
Chair Walker, there are no members of the committee. Marjorie.
Yeah, I mean, and I can see that. Leave,
yes.
I think Senator Moore sat down talking to the staff.
I think that you know, we don't disagree with you on any of those points. And I did talk to Andy Jordan from the PTA briefly this morning, and she was the one who had suggested to be sure that in whatever comes out, that there were recommendations on that parents actually be on that committee at the local level, and that also that a dietitian from the local community be on there, and that another maybe public health person in addition to some teachers, administrators, and maybe students, if you know, so that you had a well-rounded group. And I think we would be totally in support of that. I guess the only thing that we're making our point is that if all of that in good faith is going forward but has not come to fruition by some date certain, that's where we would like to have at least some minimal standard in the state. And I know that's the sticking point for you, but I guess I just want to clearly say that still remains of concern to us.
The other issue, Ms. Henrich, that is not in the federal law does not require, it requires that school districts establish a local wellness policy for schools. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say they report back to anyone. That was the other issue that I believe we discussed, that school districts must report back
to the Department of Ed. Yes.
Are you still
like
that idea?
Yes, we still like that very much. The child nutrition section of the Department of Education are outstanding leaders on this issue in the state, and I think we want to also state that publicly, and that they are the appropriate body to be overseeing this at the state mm-hmm. level.
And I think you're right about the competitive foods, which are foods that are sold outside of the lunch program. Mm-hmm. So they're selling stuff inside the lunchroom that meets these federal guidelines, and then out in the hallway or at the school store they can sell something else. But that something else can be a wide range. It can be gummy bears, and it can be pizzas, it can be nachos, mm-hmm. and all those things. Gummy bears aren't allowed mm-hmm. in the school mm-hmm. lunch program, but our nachos, mm-hmm. our pizzas, I mean, mm-hmm. that's why I said it just became an absolute nightmare to try to figure mm-hmm. out where we would go with this, and I just feel like I can't do that, and I really want local communities to do it. And I think if you require on this nutritional, each school district to develop a nutritional policy task force and you require participation by these people, I think you're going to get where you need to go. But you're going to let somebody else sit around in a room for several hours on
several
end.
Several years.
Well, really yes. Yeah. That's true. How long did this task force meet?
About 8 months.
8 months.
I was on the task force.
And I was supposed to come up with something in this work group and 4 hours or 6 hours. Can't do it. So let me get those amendments drafted. The federal guidelines with the additions that we talked about, the fundraising activity foods, the advertising, the nutritional policy task force, and the report back to the Department of Ed. And that report back to the Department of Ed would be at the same time that they're supposed to have their policy in place. And then we could also have them report back a year later, if you like, to see how their policies are being implemented. Because if you just report and say we've done it, and then there's no follow back because the Department of Ed doesn't have the money to go out to 198 mm-hmm. school districts and say how you're doing, mm-hmm. we could add it as a performance measure mm-hmm. With school districts and ask them to report that way. Well, that's an issue.
Chair Walker, that's fine. I guess I just want to clarify when you said you're going to have them drafted. This is the federal local wellness policy thing that we had last week at the work group, section 204. I just want to clarify, I had thought you were going to put the wording from the task force recommendation, which is a little stronger in some ways than the wellness policy.
I thought we had talked about that and everyone said that was too confusing, but
I don't think so. I mean, that's not what I remember, uh-huh. but you can check. I thought that we had felt that it really got out, and that Department of Ed, who I think is here, had supported actually having this wording that they felt was a little stronger than the general wellness policy from the feds.
Okay.
But you might ask them.
Pat Burke, you're sitting in the back. Can you come up and comment on that last point, please?
Thank you very much.
And Heidi, are you back there? Can you come up with Pat?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your record, I'm Pat Burke, policy officer for the Department of Ed. To the last question, report that you're discussing was submitted to the Board of Education last Thursday. The board has accepted the report and has asked staff to come back with them for a specific implementation plan on the recommendations. So to the language on the first section, we have been discussing is the drafting of guidance for school districts for what would be an acceptable plan under the new federal regulations, and to give them specific topics, such as the topics that are listed in Recommendation 1 of the Task Force report that we would expect all districts to address in the development of their plan. We also are very clear about the new federal requirement that the community, including parents and community members, as well as professional staff at the school level, be involved in these task forces, and that we would expect all districts to comply with that. And then we, even though it's not directly stated in the task force report, it is our expectation that those plans would be submitted to us and that they would be reviewed by us, and that if plans were inadequate or did not address all of the elements of the federal regulations, that we would be getting back to school districts for additional work.
Okay. So, yeah, it didn't state that in the task force report, but that's the plan.
Madam Chair, yes, we discussed that with the board at length Thursday, and I would say that the board was very clear in its expectations for staff that it would want rigorous enforcement of the policy and for us to look at those plans coming in from school districts very carefully.
And what would you say about how would you check on the policy? How would you make sure they were enforcing the policies?
That's a slightly difficult issue for us because of limited staff. We would put that into the same policy or same procedure as we do with most of our policies. There are two levels of monitoring. First is letters of assurance from school boards. Has to be signed by the superintendent by the 1st of February on an annual basis that policies of the Department of Education are complied with. It's called the letter of compliance. So the first step, Madam Chair, would be once this work would be adopted by the state board, it would conceivably go into Division 22 standards, and as a Division 22 standard, or in the standards that control the operation of the nutrition department, Heidi's department, they would become monitorable, if that's a word, by the Department of Education. So the first step would be a letter of assurance from the superintendent that the district is in compliance. When they do that, we then do paper audits and on a regular basis, but obviously not on an annual basis, we'll do face-to-face audits in school districts looking at their compliance. So we'll send a team out and we do an audit on compliance with all federal regulation or all state and federal regulations. The third thing that we want to do is be able to, as part of the compliance with the federal lunch and breakfast program, as people are submitting requests for reimbursement, that gives us an opportunity to monitor the types of meals that are being served, as well as compliance with the foods of minimal nutritional value, which are not supposed to be served during mealtime. So that gives us an opportunity to have a third check on how districts are in compliance with the new regulations. And ultimately, one of the things that the federal law does not require, but that we are going to require, is that these new plans developed by the local school districts be submitted to us and kept on file. That gives us a way of monitoring compliance at the local level with what they said they were going to do. And finally, Madam Chair, in all cases, as we get complaints, we are obligated to investigate those complaints, and that is another area of compliance that comes to us on a regular basis. So people complaining that a local district is not in compliance with the new federal regulations would trigger an investigation on our part and a visitation to that district to review their policy and their compliance with it.
Heidi, do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, Heidi Dupuy for the record. And no, I don't. Pat has done a very good job of explaining what our plans are for these wellness policies.
It sounds like you're going to be pretty aggressive about it.
We do have, we understand the importance of having these policies at the local level, and at least from the school food service side, since it's in our regulations, have some ownership for wanting to have that happen for their local school districts, and it will serve the children well to have these wellness policies that are developed for the community within their school district and have everybody at the table, including school food service and outside the student groups that are also selling food on campus.
Madam Chair, we've already begun meeting with food service staff around the state, and I had an opportunity to address them about 2 weeks ago, and have stressed to them that our intention is to pursue this aggressively, and that our expectation is that local policies would be serious and would have teeth in them, and that very clearly this was an issue of considerable importance around the state, and that they either stepped up and take responsibility for this, or clearly they would be facing more and more escalating levels of regulation. And if they didn't want that, they're going to have to get involved in this issue.
Thank you. Senator Morsett, you have a question?
Thank you. You mentioned the food services program, which I understand, but then you also mentioned with student groups who are selling and so on. Tell me the connection that this wellness policy would have to the school store at Springfield High School.
One of the stipulations is that with the wellness policy is the school district needs to develop nutrition guidelines that are selected by the local education, and I'm reading directly from the law, of all foods available on each school campus under the local education agency during the school day with the objectives of promoting student health and reducing childhood obesity. So, I mean, all foods, not just those in the National School Lunch Program, and available during the school day. So they will need to address those issues.
Okay. That may I? Mm-hmm. That would then address the issue that was raised the other night about consistency in the school program. That what happens, what is served by the dietitian, is also applies to what else is served in the building. That was one of the points that we were trying to accomplish in statute. That once you set the standard for the school, that is the standard for the school. Good idea.
That is our hope.
Well, no.
Because when you put it at the local control, well, they can set policy however they wish, but that is the intent of the law, is to have it be unified across the school day.
The law is written.
Right.
And are we addressing through the task force the fundraising activities like Girl Scout cookies?
Madam Chair, that's an interesting question. We have control over some of the things that happen in schools, but not all. So I would have to say that independent organizations such as the Girl Scouts, if they are operating outside of the school, which would mean outside of the school day and not sponsored by the school, we don't have regulatory control over that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's entirely possible that students in our schools could be engaged in a fundraising activity selling a food that we would prefer that they not do. Frankly, many districts have tried to move away from door-to-door sales of that kind anyway for student safety reasons, not putting kids on the street. But just offhand, I would have to say that probably would fall outside of our area of authority to control fundraising for non-school related organizations.
I couldn't buy my campfire mints at school or my Girl Scout Thin Mints. Anyway, let me ask you then, the final point is that all of these wellness policies we're talking about do not affect the 17 school districts that don't participate in the federal lunch program, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So if we want to get at those folks, we need to put something in statute.
That would be correct, Madam Chair. The extent of the current administrative rule delegates authority to the state board to establish the rules for the operation of the federal lunch and breakfast mm-hmm. program. So we would need something that goes beyond the current rule to extend to those 17 districts.
All right. Thank you. Senator Morsett, do you have any more questions?
No.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you both for being here and coming up on a moment's notice. Okay, anyone else need to testify on this bill? And I am going to close a public hearing on this bill. I am going to carry this bill over until Wednesday. As we continue to try to work on it, we're running out of time, but I'm going to hold it over and see what we can do. Sir Morsett, any closing comments?
Well, I appreciate that you're willing to hold it over and continue to work on it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hopefully we will come up with an agreed-upon solution.
Okay. All right. Thank everyone for coming today. We are adjourned.